This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I thought we could begin by my telling you a little story that you have a trace of if you get this boxed set, which has been announced. Keith, I don't know if you know more details, that it should be coming out eventually, sometime soon, perhaps with English, in a version with English subtitles, hopefully with some of the corrections to the transfers that Keith noted in his excellent piece in Art Forum. But one of the most wonderful things, besides having finally access to these films, is a very useful book with all kinds of documents and unedited pieces from letters, et cetera, around the films, which is a treasure trove. And when you open this little book, one of the first thing you see is a preface by the widow, Alice de Boer, and the second thing is a letter to me, which I was extremely pleased by. And it's a letter that is dated 29th of May, 1987, when I was living in Paris. And as all good things happen when you're avoiding finishing your dissertation, I was avoiding writing my dissertation by getting involved with the group that was putting together the first exhibit on the Situationist International at the Centre Pompidou. And my project was to write about the films. But those films were, as many of you may know, radically unavailable. That is, they had been utterly available in a cinema that de Boer's patron and friend, Gérard Lebovici, had bought to that end on the left bank, and which showed de Boer's films exclusively and continuously all the time. But in 84, Lebovici was suddenly assassinated in a parking garage off the Champs-Élysées in a murder that was never cleared up and which de Boer was understandably outraged by. And in a strange but very typically de Boerian gesture, he decided, I'm going to withdraw my films. They will never be again shown in France, and this will be a fitting tribute to the man who whose death I'm, you know, he was mourning. So I, as a scholar, took him at his word and wrote him a letter saying, look, I totally respect, you know, the gesture of mourning, et cetera, but I really need to see these films because I'm writing about them. Is there any way you would consider showing them to a young American scholar outside of France, say, in Germany or somewhere else? And he wrote back, and I sent it to his, you know, to his press, to the Édition Champs Libres, to my amazement, I got a response, of which this is the letter, in which he basically says, you know, actually, I was wrong. I should not have said never again in France. I should have said never again, or at least as long as I live, because after all, nobody can fault me for what happens after I'm no longer dead. And indeed, it was a kind of, now in retrospect, chilling description of exactly what would happen, because not 2 months after his suicide in November 1994, on January 9th, 1995, suddenly, for the first time, two of de Boer's films, La Société du Spectacle and Réfutation, which you're going to see here tonight, were shown together with a kind of collaborative téléfilm that he made with a French television film producer named Brigitte Cournon, were shown on Canal Plus, astonishingly. And an evening soirée Guy Debord, and which, of course, all of us freaks eagerly taped, and which was the basis for the dissemination of these films for the almost decade subsequent. It is on the basis of those videos that Keith Sanborn made the subtitled version, which is entirely, you know, largely responsible for the dissemination of both La Société du Spectacle and Réfutation in the United States. But of course, this was well after I had written a long essay on these films. And so, in a sense, we're marking here with this event this radical shift from a condition of complete unavailability. One footnote, one of the films was in the archive of Asger Jorn in Silkeborg, Denmark. And so I made a pilgrimage up to Denmark and got, you know, rented the local 35mm, got the 35mm print, rented the local cinema, and had the projectionist screen it for me four times. I thought I was a madman. But this was the basis of of a later friendship with Guy Debord, which one of the results of which was some of the artifacts that you see in the room behind you, behind us, that became part of my collection of Sichuana. So now that you are in the happy position of being able to see these films, however compromised some of the transfers may be, we thought this was an excellent occasion to bring together some people who've worked on and have an interesting critical take on the situation's material to talk about what is this oeuvre of the films of Guy Debord? What does it mean to talk about theoretical cinema? What relevance does this set of works spanning from the early 50s to the early 90s have for critical practice of all sorts today? What is the Situationist International, and how does that project relate to this strange body of works? These are some of the questions that we'd like to talk about. There will be time after our discussion for you to raise questions, make comments, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm really delighted to welcome you all to this event. Any thoughts?
I think this is basically what we wanted to start with. The question is, of course, not only the availability, but the meaning of these films for us today, political or also artistic, and an interrogation on the main concepts underpinning these practices on which we will return in our discussion. So maybe without further ado, we could start with Sur le Passage.
Sur le Passage, 20 minutes.
17.
Pardon me?
17.
Attention.
Plus one frame.
Well, it's actually transferred at 25 instead of 24.
Scandaleux.
It's a little shorter.
You know, just to describe for people who may be a little surprised, certain elements of this film, which one might say contains almost all the rest in Nucci. One, maybe if you want to say a few things about this idea, the concept of the group that we see, that is it the Situationist here, or do you want?
Well, I think Debord says it quite well himself. He talks about the lack of accessibility to the collective art of our time, meaning, I suppose, the cinema, and. The next film that he made, Critique de la Séparation, is even more explicitly about situations, but I would say this is definitely at the time period when he's articulating this theory, and it seems quite clear that he's going to great pains to show how problematic it is to give a how to say it exactly, to communicate that via a film. It's always indirect. It's always, you know, as he says, it's just like this bad tracking shot. There's always this gap that occurs. Instead of, you know, it's somewhere, I don't remember exactly where, he compares this tracking shot to sort of a bad newsreel footage of Saint-Germain-des-Prés, which, if you'd see any French newsreels from the period, it's pretty obvious what he's talking about. And he works with that. And in fact, I don't think it's just a case of making a virtue of necessity. I think it seems fairly deliberate that he uses what he does.
Well, it seems to be a very strong contrast between the Société de Café and the society of bourgeois outside. And it's very interesting because one finds that precisely in 51, 52, 53, he's rediscovering the society of the précieuses in the 17th century. Mm-hmm. And precisely looking very hard at the carte de tendre or the map of tenderness. He writes about it in Potlatch. Around the same year he makes this film, in fact. And it's interesting because he says the précieux is a kind of, it's a little bit like Pascal against Descartes. It's a society which is counter the rule, the normal, the geometrical, and so on. And it is a society established through conversation, and by being established through conversation becomes an other society which can produce almost like a kind of utopian existence. it also discovers, he says, the architectural promenade. And what is very interesting here is that the notion of the architectural promenade through the garden, conversing, right, secretly, becomes also synonymous for him with the promenade through the city, which then is developed into the form of the dérive, as we know. Maybe you want to explain what the...
No, you as an architect, please, no, Tony. Por favor.
Well, we can all try. No, the dérive is that moment in a kind of group psychological dynamic of wending one's way through the city. It's a kind of automatic writing in a group through physical movement,
yes,
in a city, tracing quite by azar, but of course unconsciously, not by chance.
And often through extreme inebriation.
Always through extreme.
Essentially.
Usually after
difficile
lunch.
De boire davantage.
Yes, usually after lunch, right? Well, we did notice a few bottles on the table there. Right?
Indeed.
And tracing a city as it's sort of, as if it has an unconscious. And trying to trace, it's very interesting, the first map that Debord and Azajon make is also subtitled with a Pascalian title of the Passions of the Soul. It's trying to find the passions of the soul in a city which is rapidly transforming. There's an element of nostalgia in all his shots of Paris, I think, even in the 50s, you know, especially the shots of the Les Halles, which is already being planned for destruction. So it's almost like the kind of moment where Aragon looks at the passage of Paris in the Paysan de Paris and says, well, it's all gone already. So I'm looking, even though I'm here and looking at it physically, it's already a dream, right? And so I get that sense in the past.
And the city is both the site of all kinds of possibilities,
right,
some lost forever and only to be nostalgically mourned, but also the site where, through various tactical interventions, such as the dérive, and one of the forms that I love the most is, for example, the rigorous navigation of, let's say, the city of Paris using and strictly following a map of London.
Right.
And that kind of encounter of newness in something that is, in fact, familiar, all too familiar. But there's also the possibility, precisely in the dérive, of, as he puts it in this film, you know, the discovery of architectures for slightly less mediocre games.
Right. Une autre plat du paysage urbain. So it's a landscape, it's an urban landscape, but another use of it, which you can't transform the buildings, right? We've given up actually on large scale urban renewal. We can't transfer the buildings, but we can transform the psyche of the city, you know, from Baudelaire to Rimbaud to Verlaine to Debord.
Right. I think what this calls up maybe is the surrealists, in a sense, who would, one of their games was to go in the boulevard and go from cinema to cinema and see films at random, not making any consistent story. But I think what surprises me again each time that I see this and hear the soundtrack is the classicism of the form. There's something that I think is particularly Debord's, coupled with a sort of Marxism. That's also something that is not surrealist, but an extremely poetic a poem to Paris, you might say, with a lot of nostalgia. How do you, is that something that you see as productive or symptomatic, this?
I want to back up a little bit. I would have to object somewhat to the, although there's clearly a line which passes through the surrealists, the situationists are very skeptical about the richness of the unconscious. And so it's not exactly, we're not talking about nausea here. It is a tactic, a purposeful one, and while there is a certain way in which it's hard to say, I mean, if you're walking around, even someplace you know very well, and you're completely wrecked, you're going to get a different view of it. But there is still always this project of sort of a theoretical positioning and articulation of things, which is not really a, I would say that you might want to substitute sort of the social for the unconscious. They're interested in there's always a sociological aspect to
right.
psychogeography, even if it's coined somewhat problematically or somewhat offhandedly. That the aspect of it, I would say, and this kind of ties in with nostalgia, there's a point in which Du Bois says something about small groups and their own private languages, which sounds very much like an essay that appeared in one of the SI journals by Michelle Bernstein, in which she talks about the need for secret languages. And the language that they're talking about is really the language of the coquillard. It's the sort of thieves that were followers of, or the group of thieves that in the latter part of his life, François Villon associated himself with. And both, it's interesting that both Michelle Bernstein and Alice Becker Ho have written extensively on this. There's a book that she just happened to be reading at the moment that it's something like, it's called Argot, the Inheritors in Bastardy. And she talks about the relationship between, I would suggest if there's a nostalgic connection, it's with the Knights Errant. And with, but with a very disabused understanding of what they were,
right.
A very interesting and not non-traditional sense of the what they call a lot of the Provençal troubadours wrote in kind of a secret language, a trobar clus, and there's a way in which there's a direct comparison made between these new words like dérive and détournement, which they formulate. They even give a dictionary for those interested, of articulating a new language which is deliberately set at variance with those traditions.
Keith, maybe we just interrupt for a second and,
yeah.
and say, for those, just to make sure we're all on the same page, détournement. Let's just develop a quick working definition. In a sense, we have a beautiful catalog in this film of détournement, at least in its cinematic manifestation. What is détournement, and why is it so central to the SI project, and certainly to Du Bois' cinematic project?
Well, in French, détournement has three basic meanings. The first one is embezzlement, like a détournement de fonds. The second one is hijacking, like a détournement de navire. And the third one is what should we call it? Corruption of a minor,
yep.
like a détournement du mineur. And with these meanings in mind, they provide their own definition, which is the reuse of pre-existing materials in a higher construction of the milieu. Said a little less opaquely, it means quotations, both in the sense of verbal quotations and filmic quotations.
In a word, tactical plagiarism.
Exactly.
So, in other words, taking, in this case, you saw, excuse me, pieces of other films, citations of other works. A lot of the voiceover are texts taken from all kinds of sources. Some of the images you saw were taken from films, photographs, and even the blank or white screen is itself, you could say, a citation, plagiarism, refunctioning, recycling of perhaps the key moment of Du Bois' Succès de Scandale, the 1952 Hurlement en faveur de Sade, which, as many of you may know, is a film that was technically described as a film without images. When there was a voice on the voiceover, on the soundtrack, you saw a white screen, and when there was silence on the soundtrack, you saw a black screen, up to and including the final 24-minute long black silence, which, as you can imagine, caused quite a bit of unease in the audience. Indeed, here, I would say this film, in its citation of that moment, a kind of reductio moment of cinema, not only refers to this early
experiment in another moment in De Boer's career, his letterist phase, and we can talk about the letterists in a moment, but this question of, as one of the phrases at the end of the film says, le cinéma est à détruire aussi. Cinema too must be destroyed. So we're talking about, we're witnessing here an attempt to think through the destruction of a certain cinema and the invention, you know, tentative, exploratory as it may be, of a different kind of cinema. What kind of a new cinema is it? How does it compare to other work being done at the time? Early Godard, et cetera, et cetera. This might also be something that we could talk about also in the context of détournement and dérive.
And this rhyme that I think is more obvious in French, vie, ville, everyday life and the city, somehow that is, I think, needs the film to be posited but then has to be negated or critiqued. Which leads me to one question I have, since you know De Boer's works far better than I do. She's the role of Marx or Marxism or a certain Marxism. There were obviously lots of quotes or half quotes from Marx. Would you say that Marx is also détourné, or is he more than just a text that will function next to Pascal and lots of other writers?
Well, I mean, 1952, right? I mean, Paris, 1952, with the Algerian War at its height, with oppression of both demonstrations in Algeria and in France and across Europe at their height, with very antique methods, right? So that we've come out of the Second World War, we're only 7 years out of the Second World War, de Gaulle is still at the height of his power. Mm. At the same time, we're living in a pre-war world with pre-war attitudes from the ruling classes. Mm. And at the same time, we are opening a society of consumption, which is, you know, parodied in the soap and the fingernails and the sort of the beauty adverts and the car adverts and so on and so forth. Those kinds of clashes are brilliantly portrayed in this film, I think. I mean, the politics of this film is on the one hand incredibly overt, but on the other hand extremely subtly mediated to show how those worlds are in fact living not just side by side but inside each other, mm-hmm. in that Paris. And it's very difficult to extract, you know, each of those things. And I think Marx is a way that, and of course the Breton and Aragon were Marxists, right? Mm. They were communists, in fact.
PC members,
right,
yeah.
PC members. So I think that the Marxism of De Boer and his generation is a very selective Marxism. And mm-hmm. it becomes, in the late 50s, the Marxism of early Althusser and the young Marx, and mm-hmm. the sort of just post-Hegelian Marx. And I think there's a whole discussion to be made actually about De Boer and Hegel and the Marxization of Hegel as the young Marxist manuscripts, the Anti-Düring and so on, are being discovered
exactly.
at that moment.
Just coming back.
And
mm-hmm.
translated in the very bookstores that Potlatch is being distributed in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is a rereading of Marx is definitely part of the intellectual horizon, but there's also a kind of rereading of Marx through Hegel,
right.
and specifically through the neo-Hegelians in Society of the Spectacle. And we were mentioning this earlier. There's a quotation from August von Chiaskowski in a book called Prolegomena to Historiosophy, in which Hegel thought basically he had arrived at the end of philosophy. Philosophy ended with him. And he also thought that art had suffered a similar kind of fate. And so what von Chiaskowski talks about is what comes next. And he calls it post-theoretical synthetic praxis. Okay. And I think that the complexity that you're talking about there is precisely that. He's not philosophizing over an image, as Godard sometimes does, but rather he is, my bad, but he's trying to make an image which is, or he's giving a complex use of the cinema. There's some place in their definitions where they say that there can be no situationist cinema, but there can only be a situationist use of those means. Now, of course, they do contradict themselves later on. René Vianney does call for a situationist cinema. So in a way, it's a small point, but it's also a kind of important point about being, well, finding their own particular place, building their own reading of history out of these fragments, and creating a sort of something, you know, it's meant to be fun, but it's also meant to be something you can't express any other way.
And continuously resisting reification, right?
Exactly.
Like there's no situationism, only the
exactly.
use of situationist mm-hmm. means. There's no labeling, right? Although they
right.
label like crazy, the
right.
labels are continuously taken off and floating and repositioned in a different image.
Right, they refuse to be labeled while they're quite willing to label
others
people.
With derogatory ones. Maybe it might help for me to just quickly list some of the citations, some of the authors cited in the voiceover of the film you just saw. This, at least as according to a series of critical sources identified for me by Debord. One of the first voiceovers by Henri Lefebvre, then a quote by Marx, then a quote by what he calls pseudo-Pascal, Huizinga.
That sounds terribly surprising.
Given the question of the game and play is
yeah.
central. Marx, Lenin, and the sociologist Edgar Morin, whose work L'Homme Ordinaire au Cinéma just came out in an English translation last year. Very interesting figure. Anyway, it gives you a sense of the landscape.
And I very recently found the black screen and then the white screen are actually quotations from his favorite English novel, Tristram Shandy, which he quotes at the end of his life about the whole problem
really nice.
Of mapping and mm-hmm. how, in fact, you can't actually narrate anything without a map, but you can't make a map of a narration. It's a beautiful quote. But you suddenly realize that the black page in Tristram Shandy, right, which cuts the narrative in a particular way, becomes the black page on the screen.
So you've already given us a hint then in one of the key tactical moves of this cinema, refusal of a certain kind of narrative logic.
Right.
Right. He says, when we see the first white screen of the film we just saw, he says, in order to really properly critique a social formation, you have to critique or refuse all forms of language of that social formation. So if the dominant cinematic language is a certain, what film theorists and narratologists have called classical Hollywood narration, it refuses that. And yet he invokes at least two other genres, always also the kind of meta-theoretical or the film-theoretical comments always come at the white screen, so a good flag. One, he talks about a theory of documentary. What would it mean to make a documentary about a particular historical moment? Mm-hmm. A question which this film, I think, could be read as, in some sense, also an answer to. And another white screen, he talks about another genre, which is the art film.
Yes.
Right? And Debord's relationship to aesthetic practice, indeed, the entire situationist project and its relationship to, initially, what was a series of avant-garde formations, even in their refusal of dominant critical artistic practice, nevertheless artistic practices, and this was the problem, of course, for the curatorial team that was putting together an exhibit in a museum. What do you do with a formation where the question of works, in any sense of something you could put on a wall, drops out, and drops out very fast, and where indeed the notion of the aestheticized framed pamphlet, like the one you see there, is in fact anathema, is in fact a gross caricature of everything they were trying to do. Aestheticization, reification, commodification, et cetera, et cetera.
One of the things that's left out of our analysis of the voiceover and the quotations in both the images and the voiceover is, of course, all the music is quotation. And all the music is absolutely precisely quoted. There's one magnificent moment at the end when the royal fireworks music comes up in the Place de Cannes as a kind of extraordinary evocation of the power of the sort of the ancien regime, you know, and then back to the cafe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Maybe leads us to one question I also have, which is perhaps more conceptual, which is the way situation was already used by Sartre in his own critique of reification. And Sartre is never quoted as far as I know.
Guess why?
Also, and so because he's perhaps the dangerous double of what they are trying to do, but what I was trying to think through here is how can this critique of, say, alienation, reification, commodification be wielded in the name of a group that is obviously outside the circuit of production? So is negation like the has to be radical, everything has to be destroyed, or can there be something like a dialectical negation or a political negation?
Well, one way to perhaps begin, and Tony, maybe you can speak to this, is just as complicated and seemingly contradictory as the project of what it would mean to make situationist cinema is equally the question of what would it mean to think situationist architecture.
Mm-hmm.
At early points in the project, there is something like a notion of, well, we could actually build something. And the relationship with Constant, et cetera, seems to promise, hold out the promise of another way of building.
Right.
But anyway, that do you see that as a way of perhaps talking about the constructive possibility and its limits?
There is a moment when there is obviously quite an elaborate theory of the construction of situations, right?
Exactly.
Which is very non-Sartre, right? Mm-hmm. But of course, the construction of situations is also an aleatory operation, which is partly chance, partly psychic, partly group dynamics, partly the environment, and so on. But occasionally, it's almost it has the ring to me of going back to an earlier, you know, futurist moment where the futurists used to provoke their audiences by throwing pepper into the audience or putting the glue on the seats so the audience couldn't get up and so on. The provoking of situations, right?
24 minutes of black silence.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. So there is a kind of an action there in terms of provoking situations. And I think there's a moment when the analysis, if you like, the sort of analytical moment of the psychic organization of the city does intersect with a moment in a kind of post-war utopianism in architecture. And I think for a moment there is a kind of confluence of these two. I remember going to a conference at the ICA in London, right, where the situationists came to proclaim their, and they were very skeptically received by the groups, the sort of utopian architectural groups in London, like the Archigram group and so on and so forth, and entirely dismissed by the establishment in architecture, of course, and Team Tan. But there was a moment where there was a kind of utopian confluence, and I think it was all around, everybody at that time was absolutely excited by Fourier and the rediscovery of the kind of notion of a kind of alternative collective, which was a voluntary collective, which could do things psychically and sexually that never had been done before, precisely because in a sense, natural inclinations could be followed. And the architects and the activists in sort of these small group movements in society, I think, had this illusion that they could build, mm-hmm. which was very quickly dispelled when the buildings of Constant looked very, very much like the buildings of Van Eyck or the buildings of Team 10. And suddenly De Boer had to pull back and say, in fact,
no way.
You know, very quickly, in 1 year.
Right. But it explains why one of the first buildings that was sort of acknowledged as potentially something like a model for situationist architecture, there are two examples I would cite. One is Constant's model for a gypsy camp.
Right.
Talk about a mobile alternative
right.
social configuration. And then this building, ultimately never built, but which I think one finds resonances in the later project for the Funhouse, of a building for the construction of situations,
right.
which would be staffed by a team of professional situationist managers who would change, everything was modular and changeable, and you could produce atmospheres and spaces and literal climates to provoke
right.
new forms of,
but
of situation.
So even in its description, I think Du Bois had to pull back from
right.
this sort of almost Disneyland of
and technocratic.
Fantasy.
Yeah.
I think there's a strong neg-utopian impulse in the work, and some of the architectural interventions which they talk about, as opposed to actually things that are built, are something like they talk about putting a dimmer switch on a street lamp so that you can adjust it to the brightness you'd like, or making stairways across the roofs of buildings so that you can go different places at night.
Refunctioning the city.
It is a repurposing of
repurposing,
the city rather than the building of the new Babylon, which was Conchon's project. And I think that...
which actually is that's where the difference with the surrealists. The surrealists who want to re-semanticize the city.
That's a really good way to put it.
Whereas the situationists want to refunctionalize the city in a completely other form. Right, mm-hmm. They want to open up the city to use as opposed to...
Where
the
use
meaning is
a use of game,
yes.
of play, of
yeah.
of abandon, yeah. of craziness.
Yeah.
Also, Du Bois is a bit of a social engineer himself.
Yeah.
That the situations are never entirely by chance. He's a great social engineer, and he's a very... You know, he's a student of Balthasar Gracian.
And
how's that?
And Clausewitz.
And others. But in particular, Gracian, because he talks about sort of how to succeed. And it's a little bit more in what Bakunin says about being the secret center of the storm. His version of anarchism is one where he plays an off-screen role. His social engineering is, which he practiced, I would say, is one where he definitely... He creates situations. He puts. Ralph Romney talks about a game that Du Bois proposed about people trying to cross a certain street, and he's the kind of person who likes to set up. He likes to specify the rules for a game and then see what happens when you play it,
yeah.
which is there's an element of chance, but it's always a kind of every situation is a kind of loosely laboratory situation.
But that seems so at odds with the film that we just watched, right? Where is the notion of playfulness, of humor, of les passions de l'amour, which you see an example here behind us in the room, psychogeographic map of Paris? Maybe I'm missing it, but do you see that playfulness in these films? And if not, what does that tell us? I mean,
is there a shift, do you think?
I think there's a certain amount of playfulness here. I think there's also, as he says in Critique, there's a great deal of sort of, there's a number of in-jokes. If you recognize the players,
exactly.
there's certain people that he keeps focusing on. His then partner, later wife, Michel Bernstein, is there. And there's the still that he focuses on is where Michel is sitting across the table and he has his arm around the neck of this other woman there. So there's a lot of these... He's referring to a lot of sort of little games that go on within the cafe world, and it's playful in a very, you know, sort of sharply ironic way.
I think that this points us precisely to one way to understand how a film could do, as he puts it at the beginning of the film we just saw, to produce une micro-société provisoire, a provisional micro-society, and that's through a certain... often ironic, wink, wink, private language, new form of language, but also a form of a kind of encryption. This is a film where every image is a kind of cipher, whether it's recognizing that one of the first streets and houses you see from the left bank is the building that Du Bois lived in all his life, or whether it's recognition of certain... spaces, what was later called Le Continent Contrescarpe, around the Pantheon, where the SI had its offices, and which then became the kind of space of the May 68 insurrection. There's, in a sense, the more you know, the more part of the group you are, and the more, as it were, it speaks to you, and the more, like the journal itself, you begin to recognize the creation of a community through a kind of collective production.
Mm-hmm. And a continuous an inclusion followed by an exclusion. I mean,
yes.
Talk about the social engineering, right? I mean,
absolutely,
right?
Throughout the whole history of it,
there was only one left at the end. Right?
Yeah.
Actually, three, I think.
Three.
Well,
it was Vianney, Michel Bernstein, and Debord, and finally, just at the point of, I think they dissolved it at the end.
And I mean, you could also read perhaps this is too thematically coherent, but what is his own suicide but a kind of auto-exclusion. I will have the last word, not mere biology. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Goodbye. And I say that as somebody who himself was excluded. I, of course, having become friends with Debord at one point and was meeting with him regularly to talk about the research I was doing, et cetera, et cetera, I then made a mistake. I had some friends at Zone Books who were trying to have published the new translation, which then was published, by Donald Nicholson Smith of the Society of the Spectacle, and Debord was not giving his permission. And so they said, Tom, would you see the guy, would you please intervene on our behalf and get him to say okay? And so the next time I went to his house for dinner, I, between incredible number of bottles of wine, said, look, I've looked at this translation, it's really very good, it's not how I would translate it, but it's serious and we need a new translation, would you please, why are you objecting? And what, of course, I hadn't realized is the translator, Nicholson Smith, was an ex-C2. And thus, by advocating the work of somebody he had excluded, I had gone over to, as he put it, the side of les gangsters.
Wasn't there a matter of money as well? They didn't want to pay him?
I think, who knows? This may be the melodramatic, high moral groundization of what was ultimately pecuniary, but... However it may be, the result for me was, Debord put it in classically Debordian fashion, je me vois forcé de te rayer de la liste de mes amis. I can do nothing, I have no choice but to cross you out from the list of my friends. And indeed, I never spoke to him again.
You probably did it literally, too.
Yeah, next. Yeah.
To have been excluded by Debord, I think that already justifies a whole career. But I think we could take maybe two questions now before moving on. Just whether. Yeah.
Just a quick question for Debord. In your Akbar article, you talked about the little about the dark part of the question. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on what you said about what the box that you need.
So for those of you in the back who couldn't hear, it was a question about the relationship of Debord with the more or less contemporary works of Godard.
Well, I guess I'd say two things in response. I'm not a profound scholar of Godard, but I think if you look what Godard is doing in 1957 and what is happening here, I think you'll see that this film, and it's what I asserted and I believe to be true, that in a way this film has almost all of the cinematic tropes of the French New Wave in one film. Godard works through some of those eventually. It really has more to do with...
Well, give us an example or two.
Well, for example, the white screen and the black screen, which I believe Godard uses in Le Gai Savoir. There was some...
Much later than this.
Okay. And what happened was... What set Debord off was somebody praising this use of a black screen for a nearly interminable amount of time, which was maybe 15 seconds, when he had made a film where the last 24 minutes of a feature-length film are, in fact, absolutely black and absolutely silent in a way that you can't even really do in a 35-millimeter film. It's a very special thing that he did. So I think it was more, the other kind of thing that I'm talking about is something like 1+1, where he has these guys basically, talking to the camera and reading Marxist tracts, talking into their nagra, It's amazing to think they could even stand up that long with a Nagra. The things weigh like, I don't know, 25 pounds at least. But just reading these tracks in a very flattened way, it would, to do the whole thing justice would be more than I can do extemporaneously. But
this one, the detail which we have to mention, of course. Por favor.
No. You're the one who noticed it, first of all.
I hope we're not talking about the same thing, which is, of course, did you notice the soap ad at the end of the film? Do you notice who the actress was? Anna Hannah, right?
Shortly later, married to Godard.
So, he
kind of, it's almost, it's amazingly prescient in even a weirdly personal way that, you know, this is somebody, and you know, a young actress who's kind of working her way up through the French system from fashion work to finally cinema work, and he just sort of points at her as being a kind of paradigmatic case, even at this point.
But of precisely everything that ostensibly both Debord and Godard are attempting to critique.
Exactly.
And at least in her incarnation as a bathwater babe. but maybe what we need to ask, in a sense, to the extent that Godard's project can be understood as a kind of theoretical intervention or intervention in cinema of a theoretical sort, in what sense these films, this film and the other films of Debord, can be said to be, in a sense, a practice of theory. Not film theory, but theory as film. And not only at the level of reading of theoretical texts in the voiceover, but in their very practice themselves, in the very complex, could one say, essayistic use of new forms of sound, image, text, configurations, mm-hmm. constellations. Contemporary to this film?
Not
or today?
Not necessarily to this film, but recently the notion of the spectator has been adopted by a group of four members of the Retort group in San Francisco, and the book was published as Afflicted Power. And I was wondering what Guillebaud would think of his use of the notion of the spectator for the political analysis of the contemporary situation, the invasion of Iraq by the United States, and the notion of the empire, the hegemony of the power for our current situation. I'm sorry, this is not related to the...
No, of course, but two of the members of that group, Retort, were much earlier in their lives struck off the list of his friends.
Mm-hmm. And were, in fact, members of the SI.
They were members mm-hmm. of the SI. In fact, the first time I ever heard about the SI was when Donald Wilkinson Smith and G.J. Clark, who were both at Cambridge at the time I was, came up to me at a political fair in Cambridge and wondered whether I was interested in joining a group that was parallel to the sort of late potlatch early SI group in Paris, right? Mm. Of course, I declared myself far too much of a Leninist to have anything to do with such things. but then in 67, just after we all graduated, they became members of the SI and immediately, 1 year later, excluded because they wanted, I think it was because they wanted to publish in America, actually. Mm.
Yeah. Well, who knows what the real reason was.
Yeah, right.
As Michel Bernstein said, the reasons given were not always the real reasons.
Right, right.
I don't know whether this...
That doesn't answer your question, but...
question, but I think...
You know, who knows what Debord would have thought? He probably would not have liked it.
Well, I do think that
just
Debord
he didn't think of it.
Continued to think that his critique was extremely useful.
Yes.
Mm. He modestly calls it the most important book of the 20th century. and he did, in fact, revise his notion of the sort of what he calls the concentrated and the diffuse spectacle into the integrated spectacle. And I think it's to be tested. What would he think of about it? Who knows? You know, given those politics, maybe he might object, but he would probably just not comment on it. Would be the most.
No, and I think there's been very, very quick assimilation of the word spectacle to the word image. And I think this
exactly.
is not what
exactly.
he was about.
Let's remind ourselves.
He specifically critiques Daniel Burstyn
exactly.
on it, who was in Paris at the time, and he, you know, and his critique of image. Also, just before you continue, there's a long history of interest in the SI in the Bay Area. And so it wouldn't be surprising that there'd be yet another group that came out of there. There's a continuing one.
But to give a kind of schematic answer to the urgent political question that you pose, and I think nothing could be more appropriate to a discussion of the SI than to pose always the contemporary political situation. Any discussion of the SI that would ignore the contemporary political situation, I would argue, has descended into a kind of self-serving facile musealization, which is deeply antithetical to the kind of commitment to the contemporary and political struggle, which is always of paramount importance. So with that proviso, I would say, if we recall that what for Du Bois, the spectacle is defined not in terms of image, but as a way to discuss a social relation mediated by images. And if we think that today, just to take one avenue into that the social condition, perhaps one of the most urgent issues that we need to think about today is the increasing abrogation of civil liberties in the name of a so-called security, homeland or otherwise, which is to say the proliferation without any legislative constraint of a surveillance in all its forms, most importantly, non-phenomenal, not of the order of the image, which is to say data valence. If that is, in a sense, one of the signature features of our landscape, I would say Du Bois' project today has an urgency of enormous contemporary significance, precisely because it requires us to think about the relationship between the production of spectacles of security, such as the theatrics which we encounter every time we get on a plane, right? The TSA, nobody here is under the mistaken impression that this is really about actually preventing certain objects from getting on planes, as the return of metal knives on airplanes in a few short years after 9/11 only demonstrates. This is about a theatrics of security. And these kinds of mise-en-scène of the political are the kinds of questions that I think Du Bois and his always collective project would, I think, be very interested in today.
There are plenty of images of surveillance, too, even in Society of the Spectacle.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The media as surveillance.
Should we just now move on to this?
Okay, yes, let's just say one, perhaps any, you as well. We're about to see a very strange kind of film, Réfutation de tous les critiques, basically a response, oh, there it is, de tous les jugements. So, Society of the Spectacle comes out, and not surprisingly, all kinds of journalistic responses are published. Some of them laudatory, some of them critical, but all of them for Du Bois equally fundamentally misunderstanding what the work is about, what it would mean to translate or to cast or to revisit La Société du Spectacle, the theoretical work, as a piece of cinema. One of the interesting suggestions Du Bois makes is, in fact, people shouldn't have been surprised that I would make a film of La Société du Spectacle, since the book itself is already constructed as a scenario, as a script. Interesting question to think about to what extent the book is itself already cinematic. But in any case, what does Du Bois do? Just like after the death of Lebovici, when he publishes a kind of compilation, détournement, if you like, of all the journalistic responses to Lebovici's assassination, here, he literally responds to all the criticisms of the film by taking the very act of film critical practice as itself part of the machine of cinematic apparatus, as itself the subject for a critical, analytical, symptomatic analysis. So this is now in response to the responses, the institutionalized response, journalistic response to this film, La Société du Spectacle, which was shown in the cinema that I mentioned earlier, and which, by the way, in the context today of political filmmaking, which has increasingly, interestingly enough, migrated into the museum. The museum has become, for better or for worse, a place where political filmmakers can find something that they could never find for the longest time. That is, a space where their films could be shown on a regular, indeed often continuous basis to an audience of however many, and of course a different set of conditions, often ambulatory or flaneurial, as Raymond Ballure has once said. But the point is, what we had in De Boer's cinema was a kind of early film installation. It was a form of installation, a kind of cinematic Bayreuth, where you made a pilgrimage to the studio Cujas to see the films of De Boer, and where, after the Société du Spectacle was shown, so too you were able to see Réputation as well.